1644 was the second large-scale Virginia Indian uprising. In 1664, land was supposed to be surveyed for the Nansemond Nation, or the Nansemond Indians. But whether it was or not, I don't know for certain at that time, but this is in the old records that it's supposedly done. In 1669, the Nansemond tribe was assessed an annual quota of wolves to be destroyed because the wolves were in turn destroying the crops and the animals of the settlers. In the mid-1600s or late 1600s, the Nansemond Indian tribe split. In 1710, Great Peter, the great man of the Nansemond Indians, was examined concerning other tribes within the Virginia area at that time. Now, this is a point worthy of noting that it's alluded to earlier. In 1711, Lieutenant Governor Alexander Spotswood, in a letter to the Bishop of London, stated that the son and the cousin of the King of the Nansemond had been sent to attend the college. He was referring to the College of William and Mary. In 1714, it was judged necessary to incorporate the Nansemond with the Saponis. That never occurred. I don't think we were particular on kissing in Lebanon at that time. In 1721 and 25, there were continuing Nansemond complaints to the Jamestown Council regarding encroachments on their lands, fields, and towns based upon grants received from North Carolina. In 1722 and 27, we have copies of the original record showing that they established specific Indian ancestry and showed rightful and lawful use and possession of the clear land, the Great Dismal Swamp. I mentioned earlier there that the Nansemond split, the tribe split in the mid to late 1600s. When they split, one group continued to go on and follow the path of the Nansemond River, ended up in Southampton County. The other group migrated over to the area of the edge of the Great Dismal Swamp. That is the area from which the present Nansemonds are descended. In 1744, an act was introduced to enable the sale of the Nottoway and the Nansemond Indian land. The sale was completed in 1745. In 1786, another petition was introduced to sell Nansemond land. That was denied. In 1790, this is an important date for all Indians. That was a passage of the Indian Trade and Non-Intercourse Act of 1790 by the First Congress. And in 1791 and 92, that's when the last 300 acres of the Nansemond Reservation was sold. As I mentioned earlier, it was in Southampton County, just outside of the current city of Portland on the Nottoway River. In 1797, I'm going to extract one statement out of this document. There's a court document that certified that all Basses of this county, Norfolk County, are descended from Captain Nathaniel Bass. In 1833, this is a crucial date, because in 1833, the delegate from Norfolk County introduced a bill in the General Assembly that was passed that authorized Indians in Virginia to go to the courthouse, and they could receive certificates stating that they were of Indian ancestry. The Nansemonds have copies of these documents. I have copies started in 1833, right on up into the latter part of the 1800s. In 1850, incidentally, we are the only Methodists, I think, in the current collection of Virginia Indian tribes. Maybe that's why we're on the other side of the but all the rest of them are Baptists, and we are Methodists. We don't hold it against them, but I think with a little time we can work with them. and we started having a spring festival every year, and so we have a big get together, and our spring festival is involved in a very simple thing. We refer to it as an Indian family picnic. We don't have stalls, booths, we don't buy or sell, we just simply get over there, we dance, we eat, and we socialize and we mingle. That's our way of trying to get everybody back together and talking and having a good time. 1950, the Indiana Methodist Church was established as a mission for the Nansman Indians. In 1889, the land for the Nansman Indian School was evaluated. That site is on the site of the little Indiana Methodist Church. The Chesapeake City School Board donated a beautiful cast bronze plaque that we installed right on that site, and eventually hope to put some type of little shelter there. The church is very small, probably seats maybe 9 or 95 people maximum. In 1889 and 1900, anthropologist James Moon investigated and researched the Nansman Indians. In 1890 to 1920, the little Indian schoolhouse that I referred to was in operation. It was referred to as the Nansman Indian School No. 9. In 1920, Dr. Frank Speck, University of Pennsylvania anthropologist, he studied the Nansman Indians and did some writing on it. During the 1920s into the 40s, this was a period that was very crucial to all the Virginia Indians. For those who are acquainted with the title of it, I'll refer to it. Those that are not should have to do some research. But this was during a period of time when what was referred to as the law of racial integrity was circulated, and that had drastic impact and result with all the Indians in Virginia. My generation, in fact, they're thoroughly familiar with it, and it's worthy of study by anyone that happens not to know anything about it. In the 1920s and 1984, the Nansman continued to function as a totally informal type organization. We had a designated chief, but the reason we continued as informal, it was because of the racial integrity law and all of the non-white type laws that had been passed and then being pursued since the 1600s, right on up until that time. Some of it was still taking place into the early 70s. In 1984, we located the church membership registry for the little Indiana Methodist Church and gave a lot of the names of our forefathers that belonged to that church at that time, mine and most of all the other names in here. And from 1984 until present, basically what we have accomplished is that we began the process to formally organize. We established bylaws, elected tribal leaders. We received our charter. We obtained recognition from the Commonwealth of Virginia. We had our yearly spring festival, which is in May. And we participate in the city, state, and national Indian function and activities. And we have continued to speak to churches, civics groups, take part in festivals, parades. Anyone over there that's interested in hearing something about the Nansman Indians or the Indians in Virginia in general, we have somebody ready to go and drop on the hat to go and talk to them. Thank you.
Thank you, Oliver, very much. Apart from all of the tribal groups that are officially participating in the conference, and I would just like to ask Chief Giles if he would like to say anything as an individual member of the Monkees now, or if he would like to say something later, Chief Giles.
Well, I won't say much.
Thank you.
I probably had maybe more advantage than a lot of other Virginia Indians. I was about 6 years old when my daddy left the reservation. And we wound up in New Jersey in 1925. After I married and moved away, I lived in a little place called Post Neck. It's one of the most exclusive. Now, it wasn't when I bought there. It's one of the most exclusive townships in the state of New Jersey. You must have 10 acres to build a house. After I came back with a reservation in 78, I got involved in some things on our reservation. We had two grants for just refurbishing the houses, put in state-approved wells and septic tanks. We got money from HUD and EDA to build our museum. We finally settled with from Southern Railroad, over 100 years of trespassing on our property.
says that the Indians can trade amongst themselves. The reservation Indians, I imagine, apply to the Pamunkey and American Isles. They can trade amongst themselves without filing for a tax number with the state of Virginia. But if they sell outside, you must collect a tax, number. And this was just passed in 1985. I don't know. Hoover's got a lawyer now working on it. Final appeal is to, so this never told anybody until somebody just happened to see it in the record. Not much of the public speaking can tell that.
You're doing very well.
I have one son that has moved back to the reservation. I have another son who was a minister in New York State, and he retired from his job. He advances back to the reservation. I have a daughter that can't come back to the reservation, but she's not married to Mike, which she is. We're slowly trying to change some of these old rules that I think ours is the only tribe now that says that the white man can't live if he marries a Indian girl. Am I right, Webster? They can come to your reservation, but they can't come to the mountain. And I think that's all I'm going to have to say on this point.
Thank you so much, Chief Miles. We've now heard from all of the Virginia tribal groups this morning, except the Amherst County Indians, and we were hoping very much they would join us today. I don't know whether Mr. Lord Johns is here or not. We're not showing him at registration. Perhaps if they join us later in the day, we would ask them to say a few words. I'd like each of you to please take out the form that I talked about called registration and take a minute and register for us. We do have your names upstairs, but it's important to have this form so that we can mail you the conference proceedings. If you would just do that now, there is also a pencil in your folder. So it's very easy to just take that pencil out and get the form registered. This way we will be able to send you the conference findings and some of the conference speeches. And you will have people circulating to pick these up in the next 2 minutes. Let me just say how much I appreciate each of the Virginia leaders taking the time to put together these events that you have just shared with each of us. And we will try to be as helpful to some of those others that would like to have help on identifying events. What I'd like to have us do now is just take a stretch and change the head table. We'd like to move into the section where we begin hearing from the scholars this morning. So keep in mind each of the events that you've heard from the tribes. Now we're going to listen to our scholars and how they have approached and their sharing of things that they have done, the research they have done, and the work they have done with Virginia Indians. Then it will be time in the afternoon to take both of these perspectives that we've given and put our heads together and come up with some plans. So let's take a stretch. There is coffee in the back of the room. We're not going to take an official coffee break. And we'd like to have Dr. Randolph Turner come to the head table, and Dr. Axtell. We'll put the two of them here with their facilitators. Thank you very much, Chief, all the chiefs this morning. We appreciate the good work that you did to get ready.
Okay. Our first speaker this morning is a specialist in an area that is crucial to the safeguarding of Native American Indian tribal history. I'm going to try to give him full credit and recognition for what he has been and what he is, so I'm going to read this again. I don't want to shortchange him. He received his bachelor's degree from the University of Virginia, his master's degree from Penn State, and his doctorate from Penn State also, with a dissertation on the traditional culture of the Powhatan Indians as shown by archaeology and history. He teaches a course on cultural resource management at William & Mary and he is currently the senior archaeologist with the Survey and Register Section, Division of Historic Landmarks, Department of Conservation and Historic Resources, Commonwealth of Virginia. Is that all right?
You got it.
Okay. And it's my pleasure to present Dr. E. Randolph Turner.
Thank you, Alderman Vernon. If someone could get the lights, the light goes directly into my slide. Is that in focus in the back?
Yes.
Good. Is there any way of getting these last lights off? Okay. I will try to keep to my half hour. I have approximately 12,000 years to talk about and 1/2 hour to do it. It's not a very easy task. In any case, most people do not realize it, but people have been living in Virginia for 12,000 years. It's a very, very long period of time. For that period of time, except for approximately the last 400 years, the only thing we're going to learn about those early occupants of the state is through archaeology, because there are no written records. Without archaeology, we will know nothing about this long and very important part of the state's heritage. Now, in archaeology, most people, when they think of an archaeologist, they think of someone like Indiana Jones. It's supposed to be a lot of adventure, excitement, supposedly gold, treasure, constant threat of death. Nothing can be further from the truth. To be quite honest with you, when you're doing archaeology in the field, it can be very tedious, very time-consuming, can be frankly very, very boring. And you don't find gold or treasure. I don't think we've found more than a couple of rings that have been actually lost in abandoned wells in all the years that we've been excavating through the Landmarks Division. So the Indiana Jones stereotype simply doesn't hold for archaeology, whether you're doing it in Virginia or down in Peru. Generally, archaeologists, whether they're practicing here or elsewhere in the country or the world, they have three basic types of questions they're interested in. The first one is, how do you go about reconstructing past culture history? In other words, the key here is answering the question, when did something occur? And in Virginia, the way we're able to date sites is primarily through projectile points, such as this one here that dates back to approximately 8,000 to 10,000 B.C., and through changes in the styles of projectile points over time, such as you might imagine, car style change over time. As these styles change over time, we're able to use that as a means of dating sites, to recognizing those changes. By the time you get to what's called the woodland period, that is from around 1000 BC on up to 1600, you have pottery occur. And pottery is very good for dating sites as well, because there's changes in the manufacturing techniques of pots that we can use for dating, such as the exterior decoration, also the temper that's placed within the pot. The second basic type of question we like to look into is just what were the life weights of the Native Americans living in Virginia over this very long period of time? From what, and this is a remarkably quick synthesis here, from what we know right now, if you go back into what's called the Paleo-Indian period, which is the very first period of Indian settlement in Virginia, dating from 8 to 10,000 B.C., you're dealing with very small groups of people. There are very few Indians in Virginia. They were somewhat nomadic. They'd be following game around where various edible plants were available. They'd be in search of those. Your structures that you'd be using for habitation, very temporary. When such things as caves were available, as in this illustration here, they would be used. Gradually over time, as you get into the Archaic period, which is the next general period of Native American settlement in Virginia, that dates around 8,000 B.C. on up to 1,000 B.C., you find populations in the state slowly rising. You also find the populations becoming more and more sedentary, living in one spot for longer periods of time. So that by the time you reach European contact at the end of what we call the woodland period, you now have legitimate villages that people are living in for most of the year. You have very formal religious practices, as you see in this illustration here from a very early 18th century book on Virginia history, where you actually have temples. This is a dance ground around it. And another very important characteristic that occurs before the end of this long 12,000-year period, is you have to find agriculture being a part of Native American life, as you can see back in here. Archaeologists are constantly talking about what people ate, whether we're dealing with Virginia archaeology or archaeology in Peru, Mexico, the Near East. The reason why is, as what you eat changes, as you go from hunting and gathering into agriculture, you're going to have larger and larger populations around. As populations grow, you find very important changes occurring in the social and political customs of those groups. A very simple example, if you had two people and they were living full-time in this type of room this size, you wouldn't need to regulate those people too much. But if all of us were living in here on a full-time basis, we'd be setting up police forces and all the rest, just because we're constantly in each other's hair. So this is a very basic rule in studying human groups. As your populations rise, you find very important changes occurring in their various social, political, and even religious customs. Now, what I'd like to do for the rest of the time I have is to switch over to coastal Virginia and talk about some of the archaeology that's been done there and how it relates to some of the very early historical accounts. Not that there isn't some very important Native American archaeology in other parts of the state, there certainly is. It's simply that if you're taking both the historical accounts and the archaeology together, this is the area we know the most about right now. What you see here is a map of coastal Virginia showing approximately 32 districts found within the Powhatan chiefdom at around 1600, 1607. Most people, not only in Virginia, but scholars across the country don't realize it, but for the early 17th century, the Powhatan were one of the most complex Native American groups on the eastern coast. And when I say that, what I'm referring to is they had a very large population in terms of neighboring groups around them. Current estimates say at least 13,000, perhaps going up around 20,000, living in this roughly 6,000 square mile area. And also their social and political customs were far more complex than many of the neighboring groups around them. With this being seen most graphically through the phenomenal amount of power that Powhatan himself held. And this was an inherited form of power, which is somewhat unusual for this area. The types of information that we have that's useful for archaeologists coming from historical resources. First of all, here's a map that Captain John Smith developed based upon his exploring in Virginia during the very first years that he was over here, on which he located over 150 Indian settlements. Not only is this a good guide to archaeologists as to where these sites are likely to be, and not merely so that we can go out and excavate this, because we certainly don't have the money to do that, but also so that we can protect them in case they're threatened with destruction through urban expansion or whatever. But also, there are different types of settlements that are on this map. In particular, there's two key symbols. One is this longhouse you see right here, and that's also an example over there and one way over there. Those were what he called king's houses. These, in a sense, you might think of as capitals of these 30 to 32 districts I was mentioning, the little mini-states within the Powhatan chiefdom. Then with the circle, with the dot inside, these were the lesser settlements, smaller villages or smaller hamlets. So it's a very good clue for archaeologists to try to tease apart the differences in settlements within this very large chiefdom run by Powhatan. Other types of information we have from the historical account, ideas of what the villages look like, what a fortification around it would look like, the structures inside, how the structures, how they were arranged within the structures, differences in types of structures. This is supposed to be a temple here, though there's some question as to whether or not they really looked like that, whereas these were houses individuals normally would live in. I'll be showing you in a few minutes an archaeological excavation where we found part of the village almost identical to this here. This particular drawing was made in the 1580s down in North Carolina, but should be very, very similar to what you find in coastal Virginia, because both groups were Algonquian-speaking Indians. Another form of village is one that's more spread out, and we've seen this archaeologically as well. One very important aspect of this drawing, dating again to the same time period, you notice these agricultural fields. But again, the importance that you couldn't have people clustering together like this without the use of agriculture. Agriculture wasn't all that they were eating for the period right before European contact. Very, very extensive utilization and use of the marine environment, the rivers, the phenomenal amount of plants and animals and fish on shelters that can be exploited. We also have clues as to differences in status within the Powhatan chief. And here's a drawing dating again to the 1580s of a chief. The most important aspect of the drawing is his pendant on his neck. That was made of copper. Copper, back during that time period, was basically as we view gold today. It was very rare. It was very hard to come by. Generally, copper was restricted to those that had higher status or rank within these groups. In contrast, here was a drawing that was identified as an ordinary older man, and you notice there's no copper. We have found the sort of difference in burials that have been excavated, where individuals that we feel were of higher status would have copper associated with them. In contrast, those of lesser status, you would find no artifacts associated with them. I'll be showing you some examples of that a little later. A dance ground. You might think this would be impossible to find archaeologically, but actually it should be quite simple if we had good preservation of site. The reason I say that, there's three specific aspects of this that should show up archaeologically. First, where these posts have been put in the ground, when they rot away or pulled out, there's only stains, and we should be able to find those archaeologically. Second, you notice where they've been dancing around here, the earth has been compressed, and we should be able to recognize that hundreds of years later. That should still be there. Similarly, the third point is right in the center here, where they have these three individuals dancing. You notice the earth is pressed down there. We've never found one of these before, but I would not be surprised if we do over the next 25, 50 years. There are clues. Another aspect of religious life are the temples that the Powhatan had. This is one of the most fascinating areas of Powhatan life, and it's also a very good indicator as to how complex a society they were in comparison to other Indians around them. This drawing here, dating again from the 1580s, you know, a priest down here attending a fire. There is a figure over here that was worshipped as a god. You have a structure within a side of structure. And here were the bodies of former chiefs. Based upon English accounts, they indicated that it was the custom of the Powhatan that upon the death of a chief, the body be taken, it be cut open, the internal organs be taken out, and they'd be placed in baskets back here. Then the bodies would be dried over fire, stuffed with sand, and they'd be placed in these temples. Also in the baskets back here would be the other valued objects of high status that the chiefs would want to accompany them in death. These temples were extremely sacred. Very few people had access to them. Very few people could go into them. Archaeologically, though we've never found one, I feel that should we come across one, we likely could identify it for what it is. Not because you're going to find human remains in it. I honestly don't think they would still be around. I suspect when a temple is abandoned, the bodies have been taken out and placed elsewhere. But what you would see is this patterning of post holes down below. This is not the type of patterning you'd have in a normal type of structure where people are living. And you also would probably find evidence of this fire. There is one possible temple that has been excavated partially up in Maryland. That's the only one where we would feel it might be a candidate for that type of structure. Now, shifting to one site that we've excavated, in part, to give you just an example of what the archaeology looks like and how we go about it. It is a site located in Virginia Beach, approximately a mile away from the Atlantic Ocean. It is possibly a settlement, and I say cautiously with a great deal of caution and hesitancy, the village of Chesapeake that the English described when they were down in North Carolina and came on a very temporary basis up into the tip of Virginia during the 1580s, around 1585, 86, 87, somewhere in there. This is the North Carolina coast here. Here's the Atlantic Ocean. Here's Cape Henry going into the Chesapeake Bay. And right up here, you see a village that is identified as Chesapeake. In contrast, if you look at Captain John Smith's map dated to 1612 or thereabouts, you'll notice the village of Chesapeake has moved further inland, closer toward Norfolk, perhaps right in Norfolk. And it appears what happened, we know from an account by a guy named William Strachey, that around 1607 or shortly before, Powhatan came into the Chesapeake area and literally wiped out the Chesapeake on the advice of his priests. And then the account goes on to state that the area was resettled. It's possible what happened, they wiped out the principal village of Chesapeake and did not settle there, but with the new people coming in, but rather relocated closer toward Powhatan's principal home, which would have been Werowocomoco in this area, and also up toward West Point. This is the primary reason why Indians were living at this site I'm going to be showing you. It's a phenomenally rich marine environment. It's right next to Broad Bay. In addition, there were very good agricultural soils on top where the village was located. But this is a very rich environment and very conducive to settlement. Unfortunately, the same reason the Indians were there is the same reason that site now has been destroyed and it's gone. It's a shame because it's one of the most important sites of all of Virginia. The attraction to having frontage on water is as great today as it was then. And now it's a very exclusive community with very little of the site left. This is another drawing, another version of the palisaded village I showed you before. I want you to keep this in mind because you'll notice the palisade line and these sets of parallel longhouses. This is what we got from our excavations. You see part of a palisade line there. Here is a longhouse, and there's another longhouse parallel to it. There were also some burials found. These are these big black dots, and I'll talk about them in a couple minutes. Unfortunately, the vast majority of the site had already been destroyed, either through construction related to this house, or right on the top of the picture would have been Broad Bay, and it's eroded away probably two-thirds of the site. What we see when we're excavating, it hopefully is visible in this shot here, but if you notice, there's a series of dark circular stains. These are post holes. As a post rotted or was pulled out and filled in with darker soil, normally from the topsoil area, what it leaves is a stain in the soil. And you can pick those up archaeologically if you very carefully take off the topsoil, getting down into this lighter clay type soil. What you have here is part of that palisade line I showed you. Here.
Can you crank that down
slightly? Okay. You're going to have to go.
It's better to leave it as high as possible for the ones in the back. It should go up to the top of the screen. Except some of the long ones go off the screen.
Okay. That looks good. You see here more of the palisade lines. Here, and you'd think we'd have found longhouses a long time ago, archaeologically. They're talked about in all the historical accounts. It's something that we should have picked up right away. This is the first longhouse ever excavated, ever found in the state of Virginia, in the coastal area of the state of Virginia. What you see are a series of excavated post holes, straight line here, curving around here, and then shooting back straight there. And there's another one right over there that you barely can make out. This has proved very valuable for several reasons. If you look at that one in comparison to the early drawings, the first thing that's obvious, notice how these are squared at the end. Ours was not circular as it came around. That was a total surprise. There are two possible reasons as to why that occurred.
Here is a question.
Yeah, sure.
How did you find the door built? Was it a flat doorway, or was it like the palisade doorway?
There was,
in other words.
Yeah, over in this general area, I believe, there was a larger space between two of the post holes. We think that's where it was located, but we're not certain. This is a reconstruction based upon what you just saw, the archaeological excavation we conducted. This is in St. Mary City. It was done by Eric Callahan. The first thing he noticed was that when you have this type of end, you have a much more solid structure. It doesn't bend in the wind as much as those that he made for the monkey reservation, where he was using slowly the drawings. Another very interesting aspect, and we're doing research on this now, a scholar in New Jersey noted up there that for the Algonquian longhouses in New Jersey, they had a circular end, in contrast to Iroquoian longhouses that were square. And from what correspondence I've had with archaeologists in North Carolina, they're saying their Algonquian longhouses down there are shaped like this. We may have a cultural trait that might help distinguish also Iroquoian versus Algonquin longhouses. Another interesting aspect, this was another longhouse we found just recently in a lot that was being destroyed. This was outside the Palisade. And the important point here is we have clues in the early historical accounts that on some occasion, those of higher status occasion were associated with the Palisade villages. And those of lesser status would have been outside the Palisade villages. This wasn't always the case, but just sometimes. But it was very interesting. This longhouse was much more poorly made, crudely made, than the one inside the longhouse. There was far less concern taken in the way it was built, the labor involved. The post holes varied in size, as if they used any post they could find. The lines were not as parallel and precisely laid out as in the longhouse. And also, it was much smaller, which was something that some of the early historic accounts specifically mentioned. Those houses of people of higher status longer normally than those of lesser status. So this would be one area that we could start confirming some of the early historic accounts about differences in status within Powhatan society. Another area is in burials, which we'll be getting to in just a second. Most of archaeology is nothing more than digging up other people's garbage, and I mean that very sincerely. There's a phenomenal amount that we can tell about trash that's been around for 5,000, 20,000 years or whatever. What you see here is one half of a trash pit that's been excavated. It's a wealth of information in terms of making interpretations. Down here, you see pottery. You can use that for dating the site. Also, a remarkable amount of fish remains and other types of plants and animals that would have been eaten. Not only does this tell us a great deal about their diet, but also we can actually tell what season of year they were living on the site or they weren't, based upon when these fish and other types of plants and animals would have been available to be eaten. Also, it gives us a good idea of the technologies involved, you know, the material culture. Here you see some nicely decorated bone pens. And down here, some ornaments, teeth that have been perforated to be worn as decorations. When I was asked to talk to this group today, there was only one topic that I was asked to go into some detail about. And after that, they said anything related to prehistory that I was interested in. That was burials. And I was specifically asked to present some information on just what was the policy in the state of Virginia for the excavation of burials. For scientific reasons. I'm not talking about individuals going out and moving sites, that sort of thing. That's blatantly against the law, regardless of circumstances. In Virginia, there are two general policies that we, within the Virginia Historic Landmarks Division, which is the state agency that I work for, follow in our own work. The first is, given our own constraints, we generally will not even think about excavating a burial unless that burial is threatened with destruction, through construction or whatever. In this particular case here, you're looking at some historic burials, some European burials at Gloucester Town that were under threat of destruction until they were found, and we very quickly went in and were able to excavate them and recover some very important information. Unfortunately, prior to the time we got there, they had already been messed up pretty very badly. You see some over here where a curve was built over years ago. Down here, some had been trashed through land leveling years before we got there. Here is a small Native American ossuary at the site I was just talking about in Virginia Beach. We were excavating the year before up here. The landowner called us up and said, I came across some burials when I was putting in my foundation. This is the foundation down here. So we very quickly went down and recovered this very small bundle of human bones there. So regardless of whether you're dealing with European or Native American burials, normally we don't even touch them unless they're threatened. They're just going to be trashed. In fact, recently we've come across burials in some National Register work we've done, and once we recognized their burials, they weren't threatened, so we covered them up. We didn't remove them. That's just our general policy right now. But second and more important, we will not consider even excavating something like this now, whether it's European or Native American, unless we have a court order. Years ago, it was tradition in Virginia, if you were dealing with a burial that was historic, they said you had to have a court order. If you were dealing with a burial that, let's say, before 1600, they said you basically could do anything you wanted with it. several years ago, some of us in the staff questioned whether or not that was correct. And we asked Brian Mitchell, who is the director of the Landmarks Division, to approach the Attorney General's office and ask if it was indeed that a proper approach to take for the excavation of human remains. So he went to our Assistant Attorney General, and he came back to us with an informal opinion. This is not a formal opinion from the Attorney General's office. It's simply guidance provided to our office, and we follow it very closely. But he stated, in his opinion, the law was very clear that any removal of human bones had to follow court procedures. And if it didn't, you were in violation of the state law, which makes it a felony to remove human material without a court order. So now we get a court order anytime we wish to deal with human remains. There are no exceptions for us. The majority of archaeologists across the state likewise follow that advice. There are some that don't. I suspect sometime in the future it may be tested in court as to just what the proper procedure is. But at least for us, we treat all burials, regardless of their ethnic origin, in the exact same way. We go out and we get a court order, and then we follow the court order in terms of the treatment of the remains. Burials are very important to archaeologists. They have to be treated with respect because you're dealing with descendants, the people still alive, but there's a great deal of information you can learn from them, whether they're Virginian Indians, my ancestors when they settled here, people over in the Near East, or whatever. They can tell us a great deal about diet stresses, diseases that these groups were facing, and how they changed over time. They also can tell us a great deal about differences in status and rank within these societies. For example, in some of the burials at the Great Neck site, that site in Virginia Beach I was mentioning to you earlier, and this comes from there, those burials associated with the Palisade not only had a much greater amount of labor associated with the digging of these large burial pits, but also they were the only burials so far that we found that had copper associated with them. In contrast, when you got outside the Palisade, you find artifacts no longer occurring with the burials. One other aspect of the burial question, and here I'm not giving staff policy, I'm simply giving here a personal opinion, but I think it's one that the vast majority of archaeologists would follow in the standard. There are certain sites that it is very, very clear that they are directly associated with living groups of North Americans in Virginia. This one here, this what you're looking at here is an island in the Nansman River that, thanks to Oliver Perry, I was able to get on around a half a year ago. It's something that I've been hoping to do for years. It is a very important Nansman site. And based upon some very limited work we were able to do in one day, it looks like it is in an excellent state of preservation. I am fairly certain we would find burials there if we excavated the very large site that is found over almost all of this island. However, personally, I never would get near that island, even if I had the landowner's permission, unless the Nansman had no problems with me doing that work there as well, simply because it's directly associated with their cultural heritage. And it's a very direct association. And again, I think you'd find most archaeologists would respect that in the state as well. Another example, this one didn't turn out to be the same, but we had a report of a supposed Indian mound rather near the Pamunkey Reservation. And in doing some research on it, we found out that it was very, very near the reported site of one of the last settlements that Opequan Canal resided in just prior to his capture in 1646. And had this turned out to be a burial mound, it was very clear in my mind the chances of it being related to the Pamunkey was extremely high. And likewise, in this case, there's no way I would put a shovel in there in terms of excavating burials without first talking the matter over with the Pamunkey. Now, in this case, it turned out to be a natural feature. It's an erosional feature. It is not a burial mound. But as an example, in cases where you have sites that would prove to be extremely meaningful to living groups of Indians in terms of their heritage, and it's clear that they are associated with those Indians, I think you'll find most archaeologists respecting the wishes of those groups. Getting toward the end here, and I hope I still have around 5 minutes or so, I'm not sure how fast time is going. I've given you a very quick synopsis of what archaeologists do, the types of questions we're interested in for this long 12,000-year period of prehistory. I have not talked about what happened after 1607. I wish I could. My point is, though, whether you're dealing with the 16th century, here's a picture of Pocahontas, it's kind of interesting because you see the influence of European culture with her dressed up in European clothes. But whether you're talking about very early contacts in the 16th century, the 17th century, 18th, 19th, whatever, though we have written records, there still is a great deal that we can learn about through archaeology that simply would not be found in those accounts. It's a very important source of information for that topic. Last couple comments on the office I work in, the Division of Historical Landmarks, and some of the services we provide and how perhaps they might be helpful to you. Archaeological sites in Virginia are disappearing at a remarkably rapid rate. It's reaching a crisis stage, to be quite honest with you. What you're looking at now used to be two mountains. There was a mountain here and a mountain here. Here's where the top was originally. It's coal mining. When these two mountains were taken out, and you see the scale here with this truck, when these two mountains were taken out, I bet scores of archaeological sites were destroyed. Never investigated. As a result, one of our primary responsibilities is surveying the state. You can't save a site unless you first know it's there. Unfortunately, the state is very, very large, and our staff is very, very small. We use a lot of help from other people around the state, but in terms of our own staff, we only have 3-4 people that can do this on a part-time basis. Regardless of those limitations, if there are areas that are sensitive or particularly interesting to you, and the history of your tribes, and you feel they should be surveyed, you feel the sites in those areas should be identified, let us know. I'm not promising you that we can come out there and do the survey. But I will tell you, we'll look at it very seriously and see if we can get it into the next year's work program for the office. So keep that in the back of your mind. Another important service that we provide is the preparation of nominations to what's called the National Register of Historic Places. This is a listing of the most important archaeological sites and standing structures and historic properties in our case in Virginia. There are approximately 100 archaeological sites and maybe 20 archaeological districts on the National Register, most of which contain Native American sites. Perhaps the most noted one is the Pamunkey Indian Reservation, where several years ago a survey was done and the nomination was prepared, and it was accepted by the people in the Department of Interior and placed on the National Register. We've also been trying to pursue this as what's called a national landmark, which is a very distinguished honor. Perhaps only 1% of those properties on the National Register, and that's just a guess on my part, but it's a very restrictive number, are listed as a national historic landmark. And hopefully that will come about in the near future. If there are properties that you're aware of that are important to you and you feel they warrant this type of honor, please let us know. There are many, many out there that we have not gotten to yet. Another important responsibility of the Landmarks Division, as a result of primarily federal law, but also in a couple of cases state law, archaeological surveys have to be done prior to the beginning of a project. If you know the site that's being destroyed and you think there's federal money involved in it or a federal permit and you're concerned about that, give our office a call. We can check it out. There are ways of saving sites through this review process. Another important responsibility of the office is what's called salvage archaeology. The slides I showed you in Virginia Beach are a classic example of going in when no one else can do the work and trying to salvage important information prior to the site's destruction. Down here you can see that longhouse I showed earlier. Next to last responsibility I wanted to mention, we, as the Central State Office for Archaeology, have responsibility for some very, very large collections, scientific collections of archaeological material, both material that has been donated to us and also material we've obtained through excavations. Routinely, we use this material for exhibits across the state. It'll be loaned out for use in exhibits. In this case, case here, here's the Pamunkey Indian Reservation, and some, certainly not all, but some of the material there in their exhibits is on loan from the Landmarks Division. We encourage that. And I hope you keep that in mind as well in case over the years other tribal museums are developed. And then finally, my last point, in terms of public education, we do have a series of publications that we provide. Occasionally, we'll issue research reports on research that we've done. We also have a booklet that comes out twice a year, Notes on Virginia. This is free. There's no cost involved. And there are articles in it routinely on archaeology. If you're interested in being placed on the mailing list, just give me your name and address, and I'll get it to the editor and put on it. Also, I brought with me, and they're somewhere around here, there's a small brochure on the Landmarks Division if you want to look at that, as well as a 12-page, 10-page, whatever it is, handout on Virginia prehistory that goes into it in a little more detail than what I've done here. Two projects we're working on right now that you might be interested in, we hope to have available sometime next year. First of all, a film script on Virginia prehistory. And second, we are hoping to actually take that 12-page handout on Virginia prehistory and expand it into a small booklet that will be sold for a very nominal price. That is my last slide, and if someone could turn on the lights, and I don't know what the time situation is, but I do have time, I'd be happy to answer questions.
Channel 13 TV is here, and we'd like to take some shots of the people participating in this forum today. Does anyone in here have any objection to being shown on TV? So you can go right here and field the questions, and we'll continue the shot.
Randy, you had you said three questions for archaeologists, and I got reconstructing past cultural history, lifeways of indigenous people. Did I miss another?
You did. I noticed that around two-thirds way through my talk, and the third one.
Okay.
I was hoping no one was going to pick that up. There's always one in the room. I saw it a long ways to go in terms of presentations. The third question we go into is trying to explain, asking how and why do these groups of people change over time. As an example, the Powhatan were one of the most complex, let's say, groups of Native Americans in the Middle Atlantic area at the time of 1607. This just didn't automatically happen. There were some very basic reasons as to how and why the Powhatan did change into the type of society that they ended up as when Captain John Smith and others came over in 1607. And that is a very exciting story of research. Any other? Yeah?
The question of burial. Obviously, you just say that.
Correct. That would be spelled out in the court order, and there's some variation as to just what does occur. Under normal circumstances, it states that the remains are to be reinterred after, and the wording that I see on most of them is appropriate study. And that would be, I suppose, if there was questions asked eventually by a court. But I'm not a lawyer. I honestly don't know. Normally what occurs is the material will be studied. If it feels the study is sufficient, then they'll be reinterred at that time. As one example of, and we've had reinterments occur both for Native Americans and European. The most recent example would be those burials I showed you at Gloucester Town. They involve both Native Americans and Europeans. They were studied by physical anthropologists at the Smithsonian, and after that study was concluded, then they were reinterred at, I believe, Abingdon Church over in Gloucester. In that case, I believe, and again, I wasn't involved in it, but I believe the Pamunkey were consulted, and I'm wrong with that. Warren, are you here? Warren, did Mike McCartney talk to you about that, or?
Yeah.
Because I thought someone had gotten in touch with you down there. In any case, that should be part of the procedure. Yeah.
You said your office voluntarily asked for a photograph of the burial before 1600. Do you think that's adequate protection from burial sites throughout the state? Or, and I'm asking for your opinion, do you think that perhaps the state should be pressed to come up with formal requirement that all
one topic currently being explored by the Council of Virginia Archaeologists as just what is the appropriate procedure. There needs to be some clarification on the existing law. As I said, ours was simply an informal opinion, and it, and there are people out there that are excavating there that don't have court order. I suspect that will be tested in the future. I'd be surprised if it won't. If we find that the current system is not working in terms of, and here you have a very delicate balance, and there's legitimate concerns on both sides. You have the scientific concerns as to the research related to those pyramids. We also have the concerns of the people that are related to those, the bones that are in the ground. And they're both perfectly valid concerns. And you need a system that will address both of those concerns in a fair way. And that's a hard thing to come up with. Not that it isn't impossible, but it's hard.
Yes, sir. Dr. Tubman, in relationship to these remains that those that predate the English settlement here, is it anything that you can glean from it to determine what or not the people of the religion have been putting out there? Or is it in the meaning of the problem of the burden of giving direction of the religion to the other?
There are patterns. Generally, and this is a very common custom throughout Eastern West, very basic orthodox, or an East Western type orientation. So there are different clues that you can pick up on religious practices, but at the same time, I've got to be perfectly honest with you, there's a lot of sophisticated guessing because the evidence is so limited and there's so many possible explanations that could explain why you're seeing what you see in the institution.
I'm supposed to be a facilitator, and I think one of the things I just learned, I'm supposed to facilitate. He has one more question to respond to.
Anything we can do to help you out in that area, because in Charles City County, so much has been lost in rattle both Native American and European. It's shocking. It's one of the biggest concerns in our office, and there is no protection of the current law, state or local, or federal, because there's no federal law. One last comment, and this relates to something that Oliver said earlier about the highway signs. I forgot to mention that. Highway signs currently are responsibility of our office. And he is absolutely right. Some of the early signs dating back to the 20s, the 30s, and 40s, not only were inaccurate, but they're offensive. It would be perfectly appropriate to contact our office, expressing your concern, and asking that they be revised. I personally don't know the policy for making revisions on old signs, but it clearly is, if there isn't a policy, it's something our office should be looking into. And also, I can tell you now, signs that come up that have been going through our office for the past couple of years will continue to go through our office in the future. They're very carefully reviewed. And I was being very, very surprised when we saw that type of language in the current science. So I thank you very much.